The bitter lesson is that no victories are permanent. All our rights are like that. They're only as good as we maintain them.
This fight is not over. This fight is not over.
Again, that's the documentary, She's Beautiful When She's Angry. Special thanks to the film's producers, Pamela Bowl, Elizabeth Driehaus, and director Mary Doerr. To view the full film, She's Beautiful When She's Angry, check out the Making Contact website for links. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Redman, Monica Lopez, Anita Johnson, Sabine Blazin, and Vera Tykolsker. I'm Anita Johnson. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
KBOO hosts beloved community in action movie nights every third Thursday at 7 p.m. here at the radio station. On May 17th, we'll show the 2016 documentary, 13. The film explores the intersection of race, justice, and mass incarceration in the United States. It is titled after the 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution.
It is on taking people from prison, putting them in community corrections, parole, and probation.
How much progress is it really if now there's a private company making money off the GPS monitor?
We now have more African Americans under criminal supervision than all the slaves.
Again, that's a screening of 13 for the KBOO Beloved Community in Action movie night on Thursday, May 17th at 7 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. Today is May 17th, which is Norwegian Independence Day. An interesting thing about that is that a lot of nations, when they celebrate their independence, they have big military parades with soldiers marching in formation and tanks and military vehicles and all sorts of stuff. Well, in Norway, they just do it differently. On May 17th, if you go to the main street in Oslo, it'll be full of children with little Norwegian flags, and they're not marching in formation. They're just sort of trooping down this main thoroughfare, having a good time. So happy Norwegian Independence Day to everyone. Well, a couple months ago, Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia were in the news all the time. If you remember, he was the a Russian intelligence officer who is a British double agent. And he was caught and he was put on trial. He's actually put on trial for treason, but he only got 13 years in prison, which seems like a pretty light sentence for a crime like that. But anyway, he didn't even serve. He only served about 4 years, and then he was released in a prisoner swap back in 2010, and he left Russia, and he moved to England, and he lived in Salisbury, which is a town in South England, and it's near the Porton Down military laboratory, and it also happened to be the town where his recruiter lived, a fellow named Pablo Miller. Miller was a British intelligence operative who recruited quite a few Russians. And so here's Sergei Skripal living in the same town with Pablo Miller. Well, earlier this year, his daughter Yulia, who still lived in Russia, came to visit, and they were poisoned. They were poisoned by a nerve agent, and they nearly died. Well, right away, within days, British Prime Minister Theresa May blamed Russia. And while the investigation was still going on, you know, I think the investigation is still going on, but Russia was blamed right away, and a whole bunch of Russian diplomats were expelled from England, the United States, and various European countries. And so once the, you know, when the verdict has been, the punishment has been imposed and the verdict announced before the investigation is over. So what would happen if the investigation turns up evidence that the Russians weren't to blame? Well, apparently that might happen anyway, because there are some problems with this story. One problem is, why did it take so long for this nerve agent to act? Some of these nerve agents, you know, they kill within minutes. And this one story, I think the latest story on the Skripal case was that the poison was put on the door handle of Sergei Skripal's house, and that he and Yulia both took in the poison that way, and then they went about their business. They went into town and had dinner and had a few drinks, and took hours before this poison did anything. Another problem with the official story is that when prisoners are swapped, this is a kind of a, that the different nations have a kind of a code of, we'll call it ethics or something. Once prisoners are swapped, they don't get killed. And the reason for that, and this was from a former British intelligence agent named Annie Michon, who actually was a guest on this show several years ago, and she says that there is a reason that swapped prisoners don't get killed, because it would disrupt this delicate system that the different nations have worked out among themselves, where they allow, you know, they swap, they release enemy prisoners so they get their own prisoners back. Another problem with this official story is that the so-called poison nerve agent called Novichok, which is Russian for newcomer. Now, Theresa May was saying that this was developed in the Soviet Union back in the 50s or 60s, which is true. But the thing is that it was only developed there, but it very quickly got into the black market. People in Russia sold samples of it to various underworld people. Other countries got hold of it, and this is the kind of thing that almost any competent laboratory could synthesize. It's not one of the developers of this thing, he released the formula for it. It's based on fairly common ingredients that can be bought on the market, and with a formula available, it's the kind of thing that any pretty high-class laboratory could do. Another interesting thing is that this fellow Pablo Miller, the recruiter who lived in the same town as Sergei Skripal, was also a consultant for Orbis Business Intelligence, which is the outfit that put out the so-called Steele dossier, which is the one that alleged that Donald Trump had done all sorts of weird things when he was visiting Moscow. And so that raises some very interesting questions. Certainly no answers yet, but we can certainly keep on asking, and that we might get some answers. Now, the question now is that Sergei and his daughter Yulia were poisoned back in March 4th, and by the end of that month, Yulia was no longer in critical condition, and she was released from the hospital around April 10th. but it never appeared in public, didn't show up anywhere. She did make a phone call to her cousin Victoria. Cousin Victoria wanted to come and see her, and Yulia said that no, you will not be able to get a visa. Well, how did Yulia know that? Well, I don't know. That's another question. But Victoria put in for visa. The Russian consulate, Russian embassy, tried to contact Sergei and Yulia, because Yulia is certainly a Russian citizen, and Sergei apparently has dual citizenship. But they were not allowed to visit either one of them. And so basically, Sergei Skripal and Yulia have been incommunicado now for, I guess, ever since March 4th. They've either been in the hospital or in some undisclosed location. The British government sent out what they call D notices. And this is kind of a thing that's sent out to the media, telling them that they are not to report on certain items in the news. In other words, a kind of a silencing of the media. And the British media got these D notices, and apparently one of the D notices says that it was in relation to the D notice said that, well, Sergei Skripal is certainly, his name is in the news. You can't keep that secret. But you can keep secret the names of other intelligence people who had dealings with him, namely Pablo Miller. So that seems to be the motive for the D notices, which have had their effect, because we have not seen or heard anything of either of the Skripals ever since. Now, just the other day, Russia Foreign Office came out and said that the Sergei and Yulia are being, quote, forcefully contained, and sort of demanding the right to visit them. And there's no reason why they couldn't be, you could arrange some kind of a meeting where they are under, where the Skripals are under protection if need be. And the Russians say that all they want to do is hear from either one of them that they are happy where they are and leave them alone, and that is it. But that has not been provided at all. So this, even though the silence continues, the questions have not been laid to rest. The questions continue. This whole thing, the Russians did it, story has been falling apart, even though as tensions heat up all over the place. And it looks to me like the British government is trying to keep a lid on this thing and not doing very well at it. Another interesting thing in England is Jeremy Corbyn, who is the new leader of the British Labour Party. I think he was elected about 3 years ago, and he is replacing the leadership of Tony Blair and his supporters. Now, Tony Blair, if you recall, he was came out back in the late 90s, the idea of a new Labour Party would get away from this working class union background and appeal to I guess more intellectual workers, the creative types, or just in general the different class of people. And Tony Blair, well, I would call him really a pretty sorry hypocrite. He was the one who joined up with George Bush in the invasion of Iraq and lied about it. Well, the Blairites, a lot of the parliamentary Labour people, are followers of Tony Blair, and they really resented it when Jeremy Corbyn was voted into his position by actual members, rank and file members of the Labour Party. And so there's been this organized vendetta against him, and has sort of taken the excuse is anti-Semitism. Corbyn has been accused of sort of abetting or condoning anti-Semitism within the Labour Party. And a lot of this is based on his support for Palestine. In fact, the Blairites even accused several Jewish members of the Labour Party of anti-Semitism because they supported Jeremy Corbyn. So one of the accusations against Corbyn, this dates back sometime, there was a mural painted on the building in East London, and there's a mural showing six bankers sitting around a kind of a monopoly board resting on the backs of some workers. And right away it created a storm because the mural was the painter was accused of anti-Semitism for having these six so-called Jewish bankers playing a board game on the backs of working class people. Well, it turned out it actually so this accusation was big in the news about 10 years ago, and Corbyn, who had defended the mural, was sort of backtracked, and he apologized. Well, it turned out that the guy who painted this mural said that only two of the six bankers were Jewish. One was Rothschild, and the other was James P. Warburg. The other four bankers were Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, and J.P. Morgan, and for some reason, Aleister Crowley, who I didn't know was a banker. He's some kind of a weird character in the sort of the Wiccan scene. So anyway, that was sort of a trumped-up charge dealing with this mural. It sort of brings up the whole idea of code words. It comes up when there's discussions of anti-Semitism, like in the case of the mural. They say that, well, when you say international bankers, this is supposedly a code word for Jewish bankers. Well, if you want to say that, then you need to come up with another word. There are international bankers who are not Jewish. So what do you call them? I mean, that's a sort of a weird logic where you take code words and use them as sort of the guiding definition of something like anti-Semitism. We have some time left in this show. If people want to call in, the number is 503-231-8187. And I would say the trouble with a lot of these theories of anti-Semitism or other is that it's a kind of a identity theory. It's an identity philosophy. Basically, what it's saying is that a Jewish people, as a people, not just individuals, but that Jewish people has some kind of separate identity from everybody else, and that it's a negative identity, which is a totally spurious idea. It's just crazy. But this is a lot of people do believe this, unfortunately. I would say the way to... In Corbyn's case, he was criticized for criticizing Israeli activities in Palestine, which is very much in the news these days. Well, how do you criticize Israel without being anti-Semitic about it. I think you could do it by analyzing it in terms of social roles. People have identities, and they also have a place in society. Many years ago, there was some famous experiment at Stanford University where a bunch of students were divided up into two groups, prisoners and prison guards. And they lived 24 hours a day at some building in on the Stanford campus. And it turned out that the prison guards acted like prison guards, and they became very cruel. And even when they switched sides, when the different group of people became prison guards, they began acting that way too. So what it means is that people tend to live out their social roles. If you're a prison guard, if you get a job in a prison, you will probably wind up acting very much like a prison guard. If you become a police officer, you will act like a policeman. If you become an occupying nation, your people will act like you're in the nation will act like an occupying nation. So it's when we criticize Israel, we're criticizing them. They're acting in a very typical way of any occupying nation. What they are doing is pretty much what other occupying nations have done. They are acting like conquerors, and conquerors tend to act alike. They do a lot of the same things, and we can see it happening right now. It's happened before in history with other nations that have conquered other nations, and now it is happening in Israel, Palestine. So that is sort of my working definition of anti-Semitism or anti-Zionism. Because anti-Semitism is something entirely different. Anti-Semitism is a sort of a perverse identity theory, which is completely baseless. If you take Jews as a people, there's probably a greater variety just among anyone who is Jewish than there is if you took a similar group of, say, prison guards or soldiers or whatever, that social groups tend to act alike, where national groups and ethnic groups do not. There are all sorts of people in those groups. So maybe that can clear up some of this nonsense about anti-Semitism and false accusations. Jeremy Corbyn is really being vilified for really no little reason at all. The whole thing about the mural just sort of is a great example, because people, when that mural first was in the news, everybody in England, all the newspapers, jumped to the conclusion that it was anti-Semitic, and they based it basically on the idea that these were bankers and they were not very pleasant looking people. And it turned out that's according to the artists, that's not who they were. They were, two of the six were Jewish bankers, and the other four were not. So, we have James is on the line. Good morning, James.
Morning. Well, you know, it's really funny you talking about code words and whatnot. You know, they're universal bankers. You know, it really, it's more of a, I would say it's probably more of a dog whistle that to you or I, it would seem like a really logical thing to say to be able to include so many people in the realm of international bankers. But for people who are within a specific movement, like, for example, there's this guy named Christian Piccolini, who's a ex-neo-Nazi, and he was one of the guys that helped develop a lot of the framework that people like Richard Spencer work with now today. And he was talking about how, you know, when they talk about liberal media, for us, liberal generally means Democrat or progressive to some degree, but for neo-Nazis, liberal media is code word for Jewish.
Really? Well, okay, then, but that raises the question, you know, how do we talk about liberal media or international bankers in a racist or slurring way. I mean, there really are international bankers. What word should we use for them?
I don't think it's necessarily the wording that we use. I think it's recognizing that to some people, to a certain group of people, yes, this is what it means. But I also think it also comes with examining the source from where somebody says international bankers come from, because mm-hmm. if you can trace where the person's from or what activities they're involved in, it's pretty easy to deduce what they mean by the words they're using. And generally, if you find within, like, other bodies of work that they continually use similar phrases, that those are things that can trace them directly back to a movement or a thought or an idea. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's necessarily the words behind it, but I think acknowledging that for some people, yes, this is a word, that this is what it means to some people, but as we use it, you know, he's like, say, I understand this word for white nationalists is a dog whistle, mm-hmm. but we're not using it in this context.
Well, having said that, we ought to be able to talk about international bankers, because I think that international bankers, most of whom are not Jewish, and they do not do very good things in the world. There must be some way to discuss them without getting all mixed up with notions of racism and anti-Semitism.
Well, I think it comes down to people who are really wanting to change things for the better and want to be able to do things, just creating our own language around the issue. Like, we understand that from an anti-capitalist standpoint, that bankers are terrible people.
Actually, I don't think bankers as people, they are sort of more or less ordinary people who do terrible things, and they do terrible things because that's their occupation. You know, they have started out perfectly nice, and they may be perfectly nice to all their friends, but they're in an occupation that does some pretty nasty stuff.
That's one way you can look at it, but I mean, for, it's like Muhammad Ali was talking, you know, it's like Muhammad Ali would say, if there's 1,000 snakes coming at me, but only 10 of them are not poisonous, you know, like, how am I supposed to figure out who's nice and who's not, or do I just shut all of them out? I mean, it mm-hmm. sounds terrible to be able to lump them all into the same category, but essentially, even if they're not bad people, they all subscribe to the same ethic. Even if they're not ill-intentioned people, they subscribe to those ethics, just like police officers. Police officers subscribe to the same code of ethics. They're duty bound to uphold laws, even if those laws are unjust or immoral.
Mm-hmm.
So they all subscribe to that code. It's not a pejorative. It's more of a descriptive.
Right.
You know,
It's saying that
because you are duty-bound to uphold immoral laws, I will call you immoral
mm-hmm.
because you're upholding immoral. It's like police officers defending neo-Nazis. We all know that neo-Nazis are terrible people. You can argue that they're good people to the people that they're around, but their ideology that they espouse is violence.
Well, you wonder how they got that way. Were they born terrible? Anyway, I think maybe another call. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more caller. Let's see if we can do that. So thanks for your points. I think they're worth talking about. So I think we have another caller on the line, and we have maybe about a minute or two left here. Let's see if we connect. No, I guess not. Well, I guess we'll wrap up the show then. I think this whole thing about anti-Semitism really deserves some clear... And it deserves clarity about just what it means and what it doesn't mean. So having said that, I wish you a very happy Norwegian Independence Day. And let's celebrate our independence in a similar way. Avoid the military hardware. Get the kids out in the streets with their flags and happiness. So Good day to all of you, and stay tuned to KBOO, your radio station.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 10 o'clock. Up next, we have Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, we have Between the Covers. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Pueblo Unido PDX 1-year anniversary on May 19th from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Join Portlanders in celebrating the recent success in helping community members win their cases against deportation and get out of immigration detentions. This event will feature a reception with the silent auction, raffle, light refreshments, and more. Again, that's the Pueblo Unido PDX 1-year anniversary on May 19th from 7:30 to 10:30 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.